Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.
It's Tuesday, September 18th, 2018, and this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Laura Satsui, filling in for Joe Moore. On today's show, we examine how local hospitals are improving care for new mothers. Plus, more women are running for office across the nation this November. What does that mean in the Central Valley? Later, we preview the Selma Arts Center's upcoming season, and we talk to two Fresnans whose film debuts at an LGBTQ film festival in Fresno.
But first, we look at one family that was stuck in immigration limbo over the so-called travel ban. In June, the United States Supreme Court upheld President Donald Trump's executive order that banned travel from seven countries. There is, however, an exception, a waiver. Waivers are high in demand, and the chance of getting one is slim. But one family from Yemen that settled in Tulare County managed to get one. They were part of the Supreme Court case that upheld the travel ban. FM89's Monica Velez brings us the story of this family and what their future might hold.
The Alomadi family from Yemen arrived in the San Joaquin Valley in June. They settled into a small apartment in Visalia and have been adjusting to their new lives. Now that they're thousands of miles away from the Yemeni civil war, things are a lot better than they used to be. Najeev Alomadi, a U.S. citizen, went to Yemen to bring his wife and three daughters to the U.S. because their living conditions were getting dangerous, especially for one of his daughters. That's Alomadi's oldest daughter, Shema. She is 11 years old and has cerebral palsy. She can't speak, walk, or eat on her own. She's laying down on a bed in the living room. Alomadi says after he drops his other two daughters off at school, he and his wife Asma like to take Shema out for a walk. He says his middle daughter, Salma, has been doing well.
She's
doing very well, involving with the new environment, new culture. Language is very easy for her, but the youngest one, she has some difficulties regarding the language, getting along with the kids because she's only in kindergarten right now.
Alomadi speaks little English, so a translator is joining us for this interview in their home. Alomadi has some roots in the valley. He says he's lived in Visalia before and wanted to settle here with his family because he has other Yemeni friends in town who all support each other. When he brought his family here from Yemen, he says they helped him get an apartment, help bring Shema to her doctor's appointments, or help with translating.
He feels that everything will settle down for himself and for the family, but he will be better, even better, and feeling like very well after like getting a Shema and to the rest of her treatment, and like feeling that Shema is in a very good way, in a very secure hands to take care of her.
Shema is also doing a lot better here. In Yemen, Alomadi says they couldn't get a hold of the medication she needed after the hospital collapsed. He says they had to depend on smuggled medication that was also expired and not as effective. Now, she's getting the care she needs at Valley Children's Hospital.
Back in Yemen, they couldn't set her any appointments, doctor appointments, unless like once every 6 months. Nowadays here in the state, the doctor visiting her, checking on her once weekly. So this is awesome for the family, yeah.
Yeah, Shema, everybody know.
Yeah,
Shema.
She's famous now.
Yeah. Alomadi says Shema is famous, and the girl everyone knows. Her story gained national media attention when they were named in the Supreme Court case, Trump versus Hawaii, that upheld the travel ban. One of the reasons the court upheld the ban is because the justices ruled it was no longer a ban on all Muslims. There are exceptions to the ban for certain people, like Shema, who can apply for a waiver, and if granted, will get a visa. They have to prove it would be in the national interest to be approved, a denial would cause undue hardship, and they aren't a threat to national security or public safety.
He couldn't believe that this court is talking to him directly, and they're like discussing his case specifically. He felt like, oh, am I that important? I'm just like... of course I'm American citizen, but is it really that important? At that time, he felt that the whole state is supporting him, the whole people in America are supporting him, and he felt that he's so proud to be American citizen.
Only Alomadi and his youngest daughter are U.S. citizens. So Alomadi says he was trying to get waivers for his two other daughters and wife. They were denied at first, but then were granted waivers.
And because the entry ban applied to Yemen, among other countries, individuals who had family members or relatives in Yemen were among the people who were injured by the executive order.
That's Leah Lippman. She's an assistant professor of law at UC Irvine. And this fall semester is a visiting clinical professor at Stanford Law School. She says how the waiver systems operated was relevant to the claims in the case about whether the overall system created by the order was lawful. After the Supreme Court decision, there have been waivers granted. As of August 31st, 1,607 were granted, according to the State Department's website. But there are dozens of more people in the Valley who have been impacted by this travel ban.
The travel ban has hurt a lot of people, whether it was, like I said, green card holders. Also, people who are actually, like myself, who aren't even citizens, have been born here, but have found a spouse or gotten married back in Yemen and have had difficulties bringing in their wives and or husbands or children and vice versa and all around.
That's Nassim Hamoud. His family immigrated here from Yemen. He says for decades, Yemenis have been living all throughout the valley, and many aren't aware of that. He says he has many family friends who are still trying to get waivers. But
with this new travel ban, it's almost made nearly impossible because there's not even an embassy in Yemen now. So if you would like to do any travel paperwork, you'd have to go to some other country such as Malaysia or Djibouti, which is in Africa.
And that's exactly what Alomadi and his family had to do. They traveled to Djibouti to apply for their waivers. Alomadi says people in Yemen still keep in contact with him and ask him about how he was able to be granted waivers. He says many still have hope they can escape the war and make it to the United States. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez.
This story highlights just one of many ways in which changes to federal immigration policies have affected the lives of San Joaquin Valley residents. For the last few months, we at Valley Public Radio have been covering these changes out of the Trump administration and their consequences, particularly on those seeking legal status in this region. Here in the studio to continue the conversation is our own Monica Velez, who will give us a recap of how immigration policy changes have been impacting different communities here in the Valley. Monica, welcome.
Hi, thanks.
So earlier this month, you profiled a woman from El Salvador living in Fresno. She's undocumented, but has been seeking asylum in the U.S. since fleeing domestic violence. After the Attorney General made changes to asylum policy, her case was turned upside down. Can you tell us more about how and why that happened?
Yeah, so during the Obama administration, an immigration court, they ruled that domestic and gang violence were valid asylum claims. But in June, the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, he overturned that decision. And what he said was that the law doesn't intervene in private or personal matters. So for Anna, her case got completely turned upside down because she was applying for asylum because she was fleeing domestic violence. And within days, her attorney, he had to tell her that, okay, like the law changed now, so we're gonna have to figure out what else we can do.
So it seemed like she was going to qualify for asylum, and then overnight things changed for her.
Yes, and that's exactly what her attorney told me, that he had to call her back like within a week of her coming in to see him in the first place, and he kind of had to be like, all right, we kind of have to, you know, find to see if there's another game plan.
And so she, of course, is not a lone case. I imagine that's happening to lots of people who themselves are fleeing, because that's a major reason that people are coming into the U.S., right, is to flee, you know, domestic and gang violence.
Yeah. So many of the local attorneys I talked to for this story, they did say that a lot of their clients from Central America and Mexico, the main thing that they're fleeing is domestic and gang violence. So for people who are in the Valley, this has had a really big impact for a lot of different cases. And it's kind of now people are kind of just in limbo, you know, trying to figure out how they can argue for their clients in different ways.
And so your reporting on this is really important because a lot of us think of these asylum seekers as they're the ones who are walking and approaching the border on foot, perhaps. But you're saying that a lot of these folks are already here for one reason or another and are seeking that immigration status from here already in the San Joaquin Valley.
Yeah.
Anna arrived here maybe almost a year ago, a little bit less than a year ago. And, you know, she got to the border and she talked to an asylum officer there. And in the documents, he actually did put that, yes, she did have a credible fear finding under domestic violence. And she was going to be able to apply for asylum. And then she had, you know, she had a notice to appear in court to try to, like, fight her case. But it changed pretty suddenly.
You've also reported on how the presence of ICE or Immigration and Customs Enforcement in the Fresno courthouses has attorneys really concerned for their clients who are seeking a particular protective visa called a U visa. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so the U visa is a visa that was designed to help law enforcement catch criminals, because a lot of undocumented immigrants are more vulnerable to crimes, because a lot of people have this fear of not wanting to go to law enforcement because, you know, they fear that they might get deported because they are undocumented. So this was a way for them to have some legal protection from deportation, and it's also a pathway to citizenship. So after they were approved for a U visa, after 3 years, they're able to apply for a green card. And this is where a local attorney in Fresno told me that he's kind of seen some changes in the U visa process. So after someone gets a U visa, all of their past crimes are pardoned. And recently, something that's been happening under the Trump administration that hasn't been happening under the Obama administration is that immigration officers are pretty much reevaluating past crimes that people were already pardoned for, supposedly. And so this is just kind of another barrier, another step of making it harder for people to kind of go into that process of getting their green card.
And so how is that situation specifically problematic for these people with these ICE agents being in the courthouses?
Yeah, so in order to qualify for a U visa, you have to be a victim of a violent crime, and you also have to be willing to cooperate with law enforcement. And so for a lot of these attorneys have told me, for a lot of their clients, that means that they have to go to the courthouse to testify. And even though there hasn't been reports in Fresno of victims testifying, getting arrested, there's been reports of that happening around the country, and attorneys have said just that is enough to scare a lot of their clients. And that's one of their main concerns.
And of course, ICE being at Valley courthouses is not a new thing, right?
No, it's not, actually. This is kind of dated back to 2013, actually in Kern County. So the ACLU, they wrote a letter to ICE officials in 2013, kind of detailing a list of instances of where undocumented immigrants were arrested at courthouses throughout Kern County. And this all happened between 2012 and 2013. And some of the people got arrested for things like they were there to pay traffic tickets and ended up getting picked up by ICE. Or one person was actually there to get married and, you know, ended up getting arrested that day.
And of course, we're hearing reporting about this from around the country as well. And then, of course, earlier this year, you reported on how the Trump administration's zero tolerance policy has been affecting agriculture and even flea markets. Why is that?
The zero tolerance policy, it has many undocumented immigrants in the Valley afraid. So it seems like there's this culture of fear that's been building up and continues to be spreading since the beginning of Trump's strict immigration rhetoric. And I went to some flea markets and talked to some vendors, talked to some of the people there, just, you know, buying stuff at the flea markets. And it was a very common thread where everybody was saying, like, for instance, vendors were saying that their businesses have gotten a lot slower and not as many people have been coming out to the flea markets. And they think a lot of it has to do with people are scared that ICE has, like, kind of a large presence in the Valley, and that that's somewhere where they can go and be deported. And the same kind of goes for customers who are there. You know, I talked to one woman at the flea market, and she said that she noticed that there's a lot of people no longer coming to these places because of, you know, they're afraid. They're afraid for their families, and they don't want to get, like, split up.
There's been a lot of reporting from the border and from other parts of the country that new policies from the Trump administration have made it harder for immigrants to obtain legal status. It's causing a lot of fear within immigrant communities, and it sounds like that's what you're finding here in this area as well.
Yeah, so the different policy changes that I've been following that affect a lot of the communities in the San Joaquin Valley, it seems like a lot of people have to go, like, a step further to try to gain their legal status. Or there's, you know, small tweaks to different policies that make it, you know, a little, like, make it that much harder to gain legal status, and also making it harder for the attorneys who have to argue for their clients.
Well, we'll continue covering this over time. Monica Velez is a reporter here at Valley Public Radio covering immigration. Monica, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Carrie Klein. Many political commentators are calling 2018 the year of the woman. More women have filed to run for office than ever before and are advancing to the election in November. Even in the Central Valley, about half of the races for state legislature include female candidates. FM89's Laura Satsui reports that despite the enthusiasm, many say it will take more than one election to bring gender equality to the government.
Eileen Rizzo is a teacher. While giving a keynote address to the Latinas in Business and Professions Association, she says she anticipated spending her life as an educator after getting a job with the Fresno County Office of Education.
I sit in my office on the third level of the Fresno County Office of Education building, and I look out and I say, wow, how did this Latina girl make it here?
But in 2012, Rizzo sued FCOE for wage discrimination and began advocating for equal pay in Sacramento. Rizzo explained what it was like to tell her story to her representative, Assemblymember Jim Patterson.
He started talking about frivolous lawsuits. And I said, frivolous lawsuits? Do you know how many thousands of dollars in retainer's fees my family and I have sacrificed for? How many women have that money? And he looked at me and said, oh, I'll think about it.
Rizzo says she watched Patterson vote no against the equal pay bills she had asked him to support. This is what motivated her to run against him. She launched her campaign for assembly back in February when she learned Patterson was running unopposed.
And I was telling people someone needs to run because the deadline was coming up, and then someone said, what about you? And I had to take it back to myself and said, what about you, you know?
Another woman, Elizabeth Hang, had a similar experience. She's running for Congress against incumbent Jim Costa.
I came back to the Valley to reconnect with family. And eventually I was planning on running, but I didn't intend that it was going to be this quickly, but when the opportunity presented itself, because I realized that nobody else was jumping in, I decided to throw my name in the ring.
Unlike Rizzo, who is a Democrat, Hang is a Republican, but both are running against incumbents in districts where most registered voters identify with the party of their opponent. Lisa Bryant is a political science professor at Fresno State.
So beating an incumbent is always hard. You know, we re-elect incumbents to the House about 95% of the time.
Bryant adds that the issues women often campaign on, like childcare and equal pay, aren't the Valley's most popular issues, at least not in rural areas where likely voters reside.
We see a little bit of that going on, you know, water, agriculture. Those have traditionally been sort of male-dominated arenas in politics.
But Bryant says that by looking at primary results, women have done well so far. Voters are turning out for reasons like the Me Too movement and opposition to the Trump presidency. Bryant adds that the Central Valley has never sent a woman to Congress, but this could change in November. Along with Hang, two other congressional races in the Central Valley include female contenders. Most of the women running for office this year are Democrats, which puts Hang as a Republican in the minority. But Kelly Dittmar says it's important that women from all backgrounds run. She's with the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University. Dittmar asked over 200 women in Congress what the impact of their position has been.
You know, one way they talk about their impact is to talk about the symbolic impact, or the both the honor they have and the responsibility they feel to be role models to not only young women, but young men, to change the perception of political leadership so that folks see individuals like them.
She notes that while representation of ideas and identity is one impact, that alone doesn't compel people to vote for a woman over a man.
And that's because partisanship really reigns supreme, right? So in a general election where you're choosing between a Democrat and a Republican, you're likely going to just choose for the person who identifies with you ideologically.
Dittmar also says that even with women running in high numbers at the federal level, it's unlikely that women will win more than a quarter of seats in the House of Representatives. Right now, women make up about 18% of the House. Sophia Pereira is with She Should Run, a nonpartisan organization that aims to see 250,000 women run by 2030. She says even if women don't win, they still make a difference.
When one woman runs in her community, there is a multiplier effect that happens. So every woman that we encounter, there is a ripple effect that comes with that. And so even if a woman doesn't win this time around, it it helps show the example and serve as a role model to other women that they too can pursue this path.
At a Fresno farmers market, I met voters like Elenita Verano, who were excited to see more female candidates.
Well, it's good now that there's a wave of women candidates for the midterm election. It's about time we elect more women in the government.
But Verano said she didn't know if any women were running to represent her. And for all of the candidates running in November, that's the real challenge, getting people to pay attention. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui. And now we turn to health. High-risk childbirths for celebrity mothers like tennis star Serena Williams and performer Beyoncé are shining a light on a health story that's historically flown under the radar. Childbirth is risky for women, particularly women of color. Williams, Beyoncé, and their babies all survived. But the U.S. does have one of the highest rates of mothers dying in childbirth of any developed country. Alarmingly, that rate rose 65% from 2006 to 2013. Simultaneously, however, California slashed its own maternal mortality rate in half, and now it's looked to as a national leader. FM 89's Carrie Klein looks at how that improvement is being driven at the local level.
This is our triage unit, and we have 10 triage beds.
The birth center at Community Regional Medical Center in Fresno is bustling. Nurse midwife Lorraine Farkas, a smile permanently on her face, stands in blue scrubs near a nursing station, a fetal monitor pulsing nearby. She says the providers on these two floors deliver around 450 babies every month.
450 a month. When you think of that in kindergarten sizes, imagine.
As Farkas walks me through the labor unit, she stops another nurse in the hallway.
What happened? Did she deliver vaginally?
She sure did.
That's so good.
That's genuine excitement about a vaginal birth. Not something most of us would casually chat about, but Community Regional has been intentionally cutting back on C-sections as well as other routine procedures like episiotomies. When unnecessary, they can both harm a woman's body and put her at risk for later complications. Dr. Jeffrey Taylor is an obstetrician gynecologist and the chief medical and quality officer with Community Regional Medical Center.
We have changed our focus from volumes and curtains and cafeteria food to what is the safest and the best place to have your baby in the valley.
Since 2013, Community Regional's rate of C-sections for low-risk births fell by 16%. Episiotomies fell by 60%. They're part of a nationwide trend in reducing unnecessary risks to women, which together can bring down the risk of mothers dying in childbirth. After all, the CDC does estimate 60% of maternal deaths are preventable. In California, however, data show we are preventing them, in part thanks to local hospitals like Community Regional reevaluating how they care for mothers.
I think that we are taking some steps back and kind of redefining how we practice medicine.
Redefining that practice includes being better prepared for potentially fatal complications like preeclampsia, which signals a risk of organ failure, and hemorrhaging. 10 years ago, Thomas describes responding to these emergencies like a frantic, high-pressure scavenger hunt.
That is the old mentality. You had somebody running to the stockroom to get this, somebody running to the pharmacy to get that.
Now they've introduced easy access toolkits and reference guides. Hospitals also have access to more data on things like C-sections, vaginal birth after C-sections, and episiotomies. They can see how they compare to other hospitals. Thomas jokingly calls it public shaming. Marinda Dutoy kind of agrees. She's the clinical director for maternal child services at Kern Medical in Bakersfield, and she says before seeing that data, every hospital was essentially an island.
It was very siloed. Every facility doing their own thing. And like I said, you don't realize you have a problem until you look at what other places are doing and say, you know, this is something we need to look at.
Kern Medical is one of the highest rated hospitals in the San Joaquin Valley for maternal measures. And Dutoy says seeing that data is one reason their scores have improved. The impetus for these changes was an innovative program called the California Maternal Quality Care Collaborative, or CMQCC. Since its debut in 2006, Administrative Director Kathy Marco says it's brought in hospitals, medical societies, and lawmakers as collaborators in reducing deaths and complications from childbirth.
Our goal is healthy moms and babies.
Those emergency toolkits and detailed hospital data are two of their flagship innovations. Marco says CMQCC's goal is to encourage hospitals, not to shame them.
A majority of the hospitals, and certainly the staff within the hospitals, they want to do the right thing. They want healthy moms and babies, and they work hard at making that happen.
Every birthing hospital in the San Joaquin Valley is now a CMQCC member. As a result, Rosemary Ron of the Fresno County Department of Public Health says maternal care here is improving.
I think there's definitely an intention, and I think they're getting much better.
And that's important for the Valley's babies, too.
We have a higher infant mortality rate than the state average. We have a higher preterm birth rate here in Fresno County. And so we have a few more challenges that way.
Postpartum is down there, and that's very busy. We work very closely with them.
Another result of focusing on moms, says community regional nurse midwife Lorraine Farkas, is more holistic care during recovery, keeping moms and babies together and encouraging breastfeeding. It's all in the name of healthier babies growing up with their mothers. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Carrie Klein. In the last 10 days, Bakersfield has been the site of two high-profile attacks. In one, a man and a woman were stabbed in a Starbucks. A few days later, another man gunned down his ex-wife and four other people in East Bakersfield before turning the gun on himself. On their face, these two crimes don't have a lot in common, but at the root of both was domestic violence, which in 2017 was responsible for over 6,000 calls for help in Kern County alone. Here to talk about domestic violence in Kern County is District Attorney Lisa Green. DA Green, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Carrie.
So it's been a tough week down there in Bakersfield.
It's difficult, obviously, with loss of lives and injuries. It's very difficult.
So how do these two events compare to the kinds of domestic crimes you more commonly see in Kern County?
Well, I don't think we have many cases where, five people are killed and then the perpetrator kills themselves. I think the sheriff actually recalled the last domestic violence type case where more than three people were killed happened actually back in 2003, and I handled that case. A husband killed his entire family and his mother-in-law. So I would say those types of cases are fairly rare, although domestic violence cases happen multiple times every day of the year.
Yeah, talk through a little bit of what domestic violence does look like in Kern County. You know, what kinds of patterns do you see in crimes and calls to law enforcement? You know, what role does it play in society in Kern County?
Well, I think that it's pervasive. And we see the calls and the cases that we see run the gamut from the misdemeanors where, someone is slapped or, verbally threatened in some way and law enforcement is called, to cases where people are murdered. So right now, I believe we have 9 domestic violence homicides pending. There are cases that are pending in court. So that's not, they didn't all occur in 2017. Some went back, further. But I think that number is completely unacceptable. And so, we deal with these cases in one form or another every day.
And so, like I said in my intro, there were, according to the Office of the Attorney General, there were 6,800 calls to law enforcement related to domestic violence in 2017, and that's just in Kern County. That, of course, is only one measure of domestic violence. You know, for the purposes of understanding and tackling this problem, how do you, in your office, how do you quantify the problem of domestic violence?
Well, that number actually surprises me. It seems very, very high. But when I think about it, when I take time to think about it, I suppose that's not that unusual. For felony cases, in 2017, for example, we had about 635 felony cases that we filed. Misdemeanors for the last few years has been fairly consistent, and that's about 2,000 misdemeanors. But the felonies are where we're talking about pretty serious bodily injury or broken bones or those types of injuries. And that's been pretty consistent, that number, for the last few years. I would say in 2018, we're unfortunately on par to file about the same number, little over 600 cases. What we've done to try to, what this office has done to try to deal with this issue is, most recently, you may or may not be aware, we opened a family justice center in Kern County, and it was actually opened in January of 18. It's a project that I've been working on for a few years, and we finally opened the doors in mid-January. And so to give you some perspective on the need for an institution like a family justice center, it's been open 8 months now, and in the course of 8 months, we've had 1,100 clients and a total of 1,900 visits, so that would be repeat visits. So when you work on a project like that and really engage in getting a facility open, you wonder, you kind of hope that people won't come and that there is not a need for it, but unfortunately, I think the numbers show that there is a need for it, and it's located here in the city of Bakersfield, but we actually draw people who come for the services from all over the county.
Yeah, as you said, the Family Justice Center, that just opened in January, 1,900 visits in just 8 months. That's amazing. And those are just the people who decide to come forward.
Right. And that's part of the – and those aren't necessarily people who are calling the police. They're not necessarily people who are seeking out any type of law enforcement help. They're seeking out services. And so we provide some on-site services. We have many, many more partners that aren't on site because we're constrained by the size of the building. But it's people who are looking for, as I said, services or counseling, and some of them do decide to opt to report to law enforcement. But we don't. That's not a requirement, and that's not a goal. We're just trying to help, for the most part, women. But there are men who seek services. Help them get out of abusive relationships and you make a positive impact on their lives and oftentimes the lives of their children.
And of course, domestic violence has been of particular concern for you as district attorney. Opening this Family Justice Center, as you said, was something you had been working toward for a number of years. You know, how else has your office and law enforcement been tackling the problem of domestic violence?
Well, we started working on the concept of a domestic violence diversion court, which is basically allows low-level offenders to primarily, I think they're all on misdemeanor offenses, but without a long history, probably in the most cases without any history of domestic violence, who get involved in a misdemeanor domestic violence incident. If they're found to qualify, we started a domestic violence program along the court, public defender's office. We spent months writing guidelines and the policies and for that. And so that, I think, is helpful in trying to break the cycle of violence. If people are willing to go into a program like this, they pay a fee, they have a shortened term of counseling, the victim, if it's the wife or the girlfriend or a male victim, a husband or a boyfriend, is required to get a couple of hours of counseling as well. And so we've tried to approach it from the other end of the spectrum too, to help rehabilitate low-level offenders who perhaps in some cases need to get insight into the problem so that it won't reoccur and there won't be the kind of incident that we've seen this last week in Bakersfield.
And so if there is someone out there listening who either is aware of and witnessing an abusive relationship or is in one themselves, what are the resources available to them?
Well, I know in Kern County, as I've indicated, the Family Justice Center. But if you're in an abusive relationship and you are, a victim of, from verbal abuse or psychological abuse, it's the fact that an individual is trying to control the other individual, perhaps trying to isolate the other individual. I just highly recommend they go to some type of the equivalent of what we have, which is the Alliance Against Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, or any faith-based counseling that might be available to them. They reach out to somebody who could help them and get them out of this situation before it develops into what we've seen this past week. I mean, the statistics are very, very clear that children who grow up in homes where domestic violence is present, or when they either witness it or hear it or are victims of violence themselves, I believe the numbers are, without looking at them again, you know, 25% of them grow up to be abusers, and 25% of them, you know, grow up to end up in abusive relationships as victims. So it's really it's not just a problem for the victims. It's a societal problem that we need to address, and everyone needs to address.
Lisa Green is the Kern County District Attorney. Thanks so much for being here, DA Green.
Thank you very much, Carrie. I appreciate it.
And the Family Justice Center DA Green mentioned is located in Bakersfield at 2101 Oak Street. You can walk right in or call their 24-hour hotline at 1-800-273-7713. Beyond Bakersfield, there is a national sexual assault hotline, 1-800-656-HOPE, and you can always call 911.
As summer winds down and school picks back up, local theater groups are starting to plan their 2019 seasons with which to entertain the Valley. And today, we're talking to Nicolette C. Anderson and Juan Guzman, both with the Selma Arts Center, to hear what they have in store for their next season. Nicolette and Juan, thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Happy to be here.
Hello.
So before looking ahead, I want to take a step back. You had a really great 2018 year. It was your fifth season, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, and a lot of praise for shows like Spring Awakening, Bring It On, and you're not finished yet, but can you sort of talk about how it's been to move through this, and maybe you can reflect now that we're almost to the end?
Sure. Well, the first show of the season kind of started us off with a big bang. We had a lot of anticipation for Spring Awakening. It's a lot of people's favorite musical. They love the music from it. And I don't think we disappointed them. Going on to our other shows like Little Mermaid and Bring It On, I think that not only was our season well planned out for a different variety for different people, I feel that we still twisted it to modernize it, to bring it to be new, fresh. For instance, Little Mermaid, we tried to put our own little spin on it so that it wasn't just your typical Little Mermaid, and I think that's always what we try to do with our shows, is just to try to give it something different for the audience to enjoy.
And so your first show in February next year is The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. You guys actually did a fundraiser reading of that play, and so was it an idea to do a full production at that time?
Actually, no. We were brought that by Miguel Gaslam and Mitchell M. Howe as a reading here at the Selma Arts Center, and it was a great first partnership that we had with them, and it was a successful reading. People really enjoyed it. They were very enthralled. So we were familiar with the show, and we really liked it. We thought in the future we'd love to have that back. So we were fortunate enough to have Ruth Griffin come to us wanting to produce the show, and she had these wonderful ideas for this production, and we were like, yes, absolutely, that sounds great. So we brought it to the council, of course, and everybody was really, really happy and pleased with that idea.
Right, and then the following production after that, which will be coming out in March, is A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder. It's a Tony Award-winning musical and comedy, but love and murder, lots of deaths. So I'm curious, when you guys will be bringing that out, how do you bring levity to something that it might be kind of gruesome?
It reminds me of Clue. You know, lots of murder, but it's still really funny. So we're really excited for this show. We haven't done a comedy in a while, and we really, really wanted to bring that comedy feature back. And this was actually a show that the council wanted to do for several years. We've been keeping our eye on it once it was announced that rights would be coming, but that was about 2 years ago. So we had kind of kept it on the back burner, just waiting for those rights to come available, and as soon as they did, we grabbed them, and so we're really excited about it. It's going to be a very tight ensemble, multiple characters playing multiple characters, and you're dealing with homicide, but then you're also dealing with like a love triangle. So it's going to be really interesting to the audience.
And then we actually have Juan Guzman with us as well, who will be directing Wait Until Dark, another show you guys are going to put on next year. Juan, what are you looking forward to with that production?
Well, I think one of the things that really drew us to this production is that it calls for a strong female role. And so people who are familiar with the play are usually also familiar with the film, which starred Audrey Hepburn in the lead role. And so I think one of the things that we're most looking forward to, this is a classic from 1966, and I think we're really looking forward to kind of putting a modern spin onto this production, something that we've kind of done a little here at the Art Center with classics or with traditional productions. We kind of like to put a little modern spin or a little twist to it, and I think that that's going to translate really well with the title like Wait Until Dark.
And then you guys sort of jump genres to Be More Chill. It's like a musical, but kind of tech-centric. And this is a Central Valley debut, right?
Yes.
Of course.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious, do you guys have any worries about running a show that will be on Broadway about the same time? How do you make it your own?
Well, we were a little worried. One, we were worried that we weren't going to be able to do the show after all, but we were assured that we will be able to. So this is an interesting show. We're really looking to bringing the show and really appealing to kind of a younger generation. It's kind of the it show right now for them. And I think our generation will actually enjoy it too, because it's kind of reminiscent of like Weird Science, where this teenager just wants to be popular, and then he gets this magical scientific influence that that's going to help him in his social life, and so it appeals to the younger generation, but then I guess like the kind of the retro feel to it really appeals to the older generation, and I'm looking forward to having it on here, and we're really looking forward to having Miguel Gaslan being our director, since this will be his first time with us.
So you follow that up with a classic Disney show, Beauty and the Beast, which we've seen go from animated movie to the stage to live action, and it's also seems like the one that, you know, a lot of families will recognize the most out of your lineup. And so how did you pick that when you got such a variety looking at all your other shows?
That has also been one of our shows that have been on our list of shows to do. And I feel that it's time. We've tackled a big show like Little Mermaid. I think we're ready to try to tackle this show. I know that it's been a favorite for many people. Most people have been asking us to do it, my daughter included. My 5-year-old daughter said, let's do Belle next. And so we know that the public will really enjoy it. We know our community will really enjoy it. But what we're most excited about is that we're planning on just, again, twisting it up, making it a little more interesting to the audience, to give them something that they haven't seen before, as far as set and costumes and lighting and everything. So we're really hoping that when they come, it's not just going to be the movie. It's not going to be the play that they've seen before. It's not going to be the cartoon. We hope that we give them something a little different. And because it to fit with more of our season, we're trying to give it a little more of a darker approach. Still okay for kids, but I think that will really appeal to our adults.
And then after that, your last show for the season will be Cabaret, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We are all really anticipating Cabaret. So Juan has some really great insight.
One of the reasons we're so excited for Cabaret is that it is going to be directed and choreographed by Michael Flores. Michael directed and choreographed Bring It On earlier this year, and also choreographed Spring Awakening, which is in our season this year as well. And so we know to expect some very beautiful movement, lots of dance in this production, and also just a special attention to vocals, again, with fitting in with our season. Kind of a darker edge to Cabaret in this reimagining. And I think we could also expect a lot of surprises knowing Michael and his direction and his choreography.
And so I'm curious, I mean, you guys keep mentioning now that maybe sort of a darker theme. Would you say this season has a theme or something that you were going for as you picked each show?
Yes. when we started putting our shows kind of on a list and picking some of our favorites, we definitely saw that this can have that darker twist, that we knew that we could pretty much spice up every single one of these shows and make it our own, and that's what we got most excited about.
We'll leave it there. Nicola and Juan with the Selma Arts Center, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find an extended version of that interview on our website at kvpr.org.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Carrie Klein. We finished today's show with a film festival. Tomorrow, the annual Real Pride Film Festival kicks off 5 days of films from around the world that explore LGBTQ people and issues. One of the films premiering in that festival is about a drag queen known in the Fresno drag scene. In the film, she shares a part of herself not everyone sees on stage. Leilani Price will be featured in the documentary The Life of Lei, The Man Behind the Makeup. FM89's Monica Velez interviewed the director, Matthew Broughton, and the queen herself, Leilani, starting with how Matthew came up with the idea for this documentary.
I was in school, so I'm a recent president, state graduate, and the documentary actually came about because I did a story for my college news class, and I did a story on Leilani called The Life of Lei, and the community actually really liked it, and so we figured why not turn it into a documentary. It kind of started out as a little bit of a joke, and then from there, once we started realizing what the potential could be, we started to film in a more serious direction. And I feel like Leilani's story is very special because you don't really, a lot of people are interested in drag queens and kind of all the, outer appearances and club stuff. But I was more focused on the inner person and what they do in their everyday life. They are the same as us. They get up in the morning, they take a shower, they do all these things. And so I really wanted to showcase essentially what the title says, the man behind the makeup.
And do you guys feel like people in Fresno have, or people in the Valley in general, have like a good understanding of what drag is all about?
I would personally say no. Overall, now that RuPaul's Drag Race is now more mainstream, I think people have become more accepting of it. But I think because we come from a very conservative valley, I think it's very hard. A lot of people have this idea that we want to be women. And in all actuality, we just want to express ourselves through art forms.
And do you feel like this documentary is going to kind of help that out?
I definitely think so. I think what we really wanted to showcase in this documentary is that drag queens are people just like us. Like I was saying, they get to the morning. Some of them actually do have day jobs and they have to go, drag isn't necessarily their livelihood. And like Leilani was saying, it's an art form. And so we really wanted to showcase that Leilani is a drag performer, but at the end of the day, when Leilani goes home, she's actually Paul, and that's the person behind the makeup.
Well, and then also for me, I think the big thing is that people have this misunderstanding of drag and exactly what it is, and that we don't struggle with things because we don't put them on social media. Obviously, it's an alter ego. I'm not going to say I'm having a bad day if I'm having a bad day. As an alter ego, I want to make sure I'm looked at in a positive light. So you'll very rarely see me be very personal. And I think this documentary really opens me up as an individual, a human being and a drag queen, entertainer, role model, whatever you want to call it, to be someone humanized,
Yeah. And kind of going off of what you were saying, Leilani, did you feel at some point or realize that you needed to focus more on being Paul Hernandez versus being Leilani?
There's a part in the movie where my sister, well, actually it's not in the movie, but during filming, there was a part in the movie where my sister, pretty much tells me like, we just want my brother back. And it was hard, when you're missing birthdays. And I tell her like, that was really hard for me to hear coming from her. At that point, I was probably at one of the highest points of my career as a drag queen, raising money, $23,000 for the local LGBT community here in Fresno. But hearing that from my sister and my family and noticing I was not taking care of myself at that point, that's when I realized I needed to start being myself and putting drag second. Drag is a hobby of mine. When you're good at it, you're good at it, but I also needed to take a step back and realize that, hey, I'm human. I'm not this person anymore.
And have you been finding that it's kind of hard to separate those two, like just who you really are versus, kind of this person, like this other persona?
A lot of people say it's hard to tell the difference between talking to Lei and Paul. Leia's very methodical, very strategic in everything that she does. She's also a little bit of a mean girl when she needs to be, but she's a charmer for the children. It is hard for me to turn that off at times. I feel like, you know, when I'm around certain people or individuals, I feel like I need to be that person. I need to turn it on. I need to be her. And now I'm at that point where it's like, hey, I'm here too. You know, don't forget about me, kind of a thing.
And how would you describe the drag scene in Fresno or in other parts of the valley?
I would say it's very unique. It's diverse in itself. We have, you know, we have a lot of queens here in this valley where there's Latina queens, Ellos Latinos. They have a show here. We have, you know, the Club Legend girls, the Fab girls who are the artistic, you know, and to me, those are the ones that shine the brightest here in this valley. We have girls that travel up and down and still perform up and down the valley and still perform at Fab. So I want to say we have a very diverse group of individuals here in this town, drag queens and drag kings. We also have some faux queens and faux kings, and those people are amazing as well, you know. I just think the talent here in Fresno is extremely amazing.
And do you think that at any point you'd completely stop being Leilani Price?
You know, there comes a point where, yes, indeed, she will be the back burner and not my priority. But there also is a thing that she was my shield whenever I felt like someone was picking on me or I was vulnerable enough, you know, to let someone in. She was that defense mechanism that always kicked in for me. And, you know, I encourage everyone, embrace your alter ego. Let that person shine sometimes, not all the time, because eventually that person's going to give you the confidence that you need to, like, move forward on with your life.
If there's one thing people take away from this film, what do you hope that is?
Matthew, you want to start?
Sure. The one thing that I hope that people take away from this movie is to understand that drag performers and people who, you know, are in the spotlight or do things for entertainment are people just like us at the end of the day. And that's a really, really big highlight. I want people to understand that Leilani is a character, but there's also this new person that you're going to meet, which is Paul Hernandez.
And then for me, the one thing that I hope will happen is that I hope that people will put down their phones and start having conversations with their family members, with their friends. There's one particular scene that I get emotional about, which is with involving my sister, my biological sister. And, you know, we never had the discussion about her addiction. And when we sit there and talk about it and you see the raw emotion that not a lot of people get to see, I think that part is where I hope that someone takes away that bite your pride, put it aside, and focus on your family, focus on your friends, focus on the people that are important to you. Because if not, then they're not going to be here one day and you're going to feel so guilty because you won't be able to have that relationship with them ever again.
Great. Thank you guys so much. We are here with the director of the film, Matthew, and Leilani Price, who is the main character in this documentary. Thank you guys so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
The Life of Lei, the man behind the makeup, will premiere at 7 p.m. on Thursday at Fresno's Tower Theater, part of the Real Pride Film Festival running Wednesday through Sunday. A quick note, Valley Public Radio is a community sponsor of the Real Pride Film Festival. And that's Valley Edition for Tuesday, September 18th. As always, you can follow us on Twitter at KVPR, and we're on Facebook and Instagram at Valley Public Radio. You can connect with us through our website at kvpr.org.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Valley Edition podcast and download the KVPR mobile app for your smartphone and tablet. Thanks to our editor, Joe Moore, fellow reporter, Monica Velez, audio engineer, Marv Allen, and production and operations manager, Don Weaver. I'm Laura Satsui.
And I'm Carrie Klein, filling in for Joe Moore.
You've been listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.